or lessons on the life of David. Let's turn to 1 Samuel 27, last lesson. We cut off partway through chapter 26. I have my... No, 27 here. I cut off halfway through the chapter, and I want to begin reading tonight in verse 8. If you recall, the lesson left off with David finally fled back to the land of the Philistines, and he had established a relationship with the king of Achish, king of Gath, and had talked him into allowing David and his 600 men and their families to go to Ziklag. And Achish gave David that land, and that's where they were dwelling. The question I want us to consider this evening is, how long can you live in the world and live with the world, not worshiping God the way that you really desire to? David has left Israel. He can no longer can't offer sacrifice the way he normally would or anything. How long can you do that before eventually you start serving the world? That's what we're going to see begins to happen here. David is in real danger of not only living with the Philistines, but actually serving and benefiting the Philistines. And so let's pick up in verse 8. And David and his men went up and invaded the Geshurites and the Gezerites and the Amalekites. For those nations were of old the inhabitants of the land, as thou goest to Shur, even unto the land of Egypt. So this was all to the south of where they were with the Philistines. And David smote the land and left neither man nor woman alive, and took away sheep and the oxen and the asses and the camels and apparel, and returned and came to Achish. So imagine the scene here is David and his 600 men, and they're coming back with all this, all the spoils. And Achish said, "Whither have you made a road today?" And David said, "Against the south of Judah, and against the south of the Jerahmeelites, and against the south of the Kenites." And David saved neither man nor woman. Notice this verse. And David saved neither man nor woman alive to bring tidings to Gath, saying, "Lest they should tell on us, saying, so did David, and so will be his manner all the while he dwelleth in the country of the Philistines." And Achish believed David, saying, "He hath made his people to utterly abhor him. Therefore he shall be my servant forever." Before we get into the next chapter, I just want to take a look at this passage. In verse 8, we see that David went against the Geshurites, Gezerites, and the Amalekites. These were always the enemies of Israel. So although he's living in the land of the Philistines now, it wouldn't have hurt the feelings of the Philistines for Achish to have known that that's what he did. But it didn't serve a purpose in him showing just how much he was despised of Israel. And so David didn't feel like he could be honest and tell Achish what he had really done. But these were the enemies of Israel. So David, although he's with the Philistines, he's still serving and benefiting Israel. He's really still fighting for them. He was not just sitting idly by in the land of the Philistines. Note, though, that David said he was fighting against his own people. If you notice in verse 10, it says, "And Achish said, whither have you made a road today? And David said, against the south of Judah." Well, man, that's not against the Amalekites. David doesn't say, "I made a road against the Amalekites." He says, "I made a road against the south of Judah." Well, what tribe is David of?
Judah.
Judah. Right? He said, David said, "I made a road against the south of Judah and against the south of the Jerahmeelites and against the south of the Kenites." And so it's not true. One of the reasons that he left none alive is that so nobody could rat him out and tell the truth of the matter. It says so in verse 11. "And David saved neither man nor woman alive to bring tidings to Gath." and saying, this is what David said, lest they should tell on us. He didn't say rat us out. He said, tell on us. But, you know, that's why he killed. He didn't want any witnesses. So when he went and did all this, he took all their goods. But then he made sure that no one was alive who could tell Achish. This was a serious thing David was doing. He wanted it to look like he went against his own people. And so, and we see how Achish responded. Achish concludes, it's no wonder, the conclusion of Achish was, it's no wonder that Israel abhors David. He goes against his own people. That's the conclusion that he came away with. It says in verse 12, and he also believed that there was absolutely no way David could ever return to his people, and that he would be David's servant forever, or David would be his servant forever. Because David truly had nowhere to go because Israel abhorred him so much, not just Saul. And so it says in verse 12, and Achish believed David, saying, he hath made his people Israel utterly to abhor him. Therefore he shall be my servant forever. So David intentionally made himself look like an absolutely an abomination to his own nation on purpose. He did that. And he's using his own methods, what David thought would be best. The Lord didn't direct him and say, lie, do this, do all this, kill everybody so no one can say what really happened. The Lord didn't direct him to do any of that. David was acting on his own, what he thought would be the best for his own protection. Yes. Note how a wicked man, David is portraying himself as a despicable person. Note how a wicked man, Achish, a wicked Philistine king, will care nothing for a man's character if he sees some benefit for himself in having an alliance. Mm-hmm. Achish, a wicked king, was willing to have this despicable person who would go and carry out raids against his own tribe in Israel. He was okay with having him. He viewed David as basically a mercenary. David had just become a mercenary for hire, and he will go against anybody if it's profitable. He will go against his own people even if he can come away with sheep and cattle and so forth and increase his wealth. That's what Achish is seeing himself as. And wicked men have no problem in having alliances with very unsavory people if it will benefit them in the long run. He thought, well, David will be my servant forever. Who cares? Well, it's something that happens in governments all the time. Yes. Where it's happened in our country. One of the things that we want to believe about our country, especially if you read history through the rose-tinted glass of biased historians, they want sometimes for it to look like our nation only aligns itself with notable leaders and lovers of freedom. For the most part, that has happened. But it's true that even in our own nation, I'm using our nation as an example, because even in nations what we would think of as the best example, we have aligned ourselves at times with absolutely horrible, despicable, not even nations, but leaders. It's happened all down through history, but I'll just give you a couple of examples. One would be Stalin. If you have a common enemy, see, if you have a common enemy, you will sell your soul to the devil as long as you can defeat the common enemy. And it becomes not so much about who's better than the other, morally or whatever. It's just about, we need to defeat this enemy. So we will get in bed with Stalin and communists so that we can defeat a socialist. Right? That's what happened in World War II. We line up in those instances. But who was worse, Hitler or Stalin? In communism, in Russia, under communism, from Lenin to Khrushchev, they killed 52 million yes. of their own people. Yes. Of their own people. But for the sake of winning the war, We work together to defeat a common enemy. Another more modern example would be Saddam Hussein. When we were fighting Iran, or not fighting Iran, but we were having issues with Iran and so forth, we actually gave all this military support and all this. It's amazing how many times we've done this down through history. Boy, we loaded up Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And then when it was convenient, then we went in and wiped out Saddam Hussein because he was a bad guy. Well, Saddam Hussein has always been a bad guy. But for a common enemy, I'm mentioning this to show that it doesn't matter what political system it is. It's just lost people as a whole. This happens in business dealings. It happens across the board in our community on a local level. People will align themselves with absolutely horrible people if they think that it will help me get to this end. And I'll discard that guy after I get what I need. But that's not how we're supposed to be as Christians, though. Don't align yourself with horrible, despicable people because it's good. It'll help you in your business or to help you get where you need to be. Christians really have no business doing this. And Achish here, to me, he's just a prime example of a lost leader of his people. And he's willing to overlook character and everything. Well, it's like, hey, this guy's a great military man, David. He'll be a servant to me for forever. And so he was happy to have David on his side. The next chapter, I have a heading for this next chapter, 1 Samuel 28. I call it Desperate Measures. And it's desperate measures by both. Now, the situation between Saul and David is it's winding down. It's kind of everything's kind of wrapping up. But both David and Saul are resorting to desperate measures in this passage. And so let's begin reading chapter 28. And it came to pass in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for warfare to fight with Israel. And Achish said unto David, Know thou assuredly that thou shalt go with me to battle, thou and thy men. And David said to Achish, surely thou shalt know what thy servant can do. And Achish said to David, therefore will I make thee keeper of mine head forever. Notice the trap David's falling into. He went and he aligned himself with the Philistines and he went to them for protection. And now, and Achish gave him Ziklag and has been benefiting David. Now it's time for a little payback. Now it's time. We're going to go fight Israel. And I know that Israel despises you. And you've been going against Israel, even though he hadn't. Achish thinks he's been going against Israel. So now, David, it's time to go against Israel. And David says, surely thou know what thou shalt know what thy servant can do. And as I already mentioned, Achish is beginning to view David as nothing more than a mercenary. And David assures him that he and his men can handle their business. You know what I can do. It's creating an interesting scenario, though. What would David really do when it was time to fight? What would David do? What was in David's mind? Is David going to go into battle? And he's thinking, maybe he's talking Achish into going into battle so that when they get right into the thick of things, then he can just turn on his own people? Mm. Is he thinking that? Mm. Or is David still stuck in survival mode? David has put himself in a very, very difficult situation. And so the lies and the way he misled Achish is going to backfire, is about to backfire on him. And so verse 3, now Samuel was dead, and all Israel had lamented him and buried him in Ramah, even in his own city. And Saul had put away those that had familiar spirits and the wizards out of the land. Now, Saul would have put them away most likely under the direction of Samuel. I believe that's why it states here. Samuel was dead and Israel lamented him and buried him. And Saul had put away those that had familiar spirits. I think he did that under Samuel. Saul was the military leader. Samuel had always been the spiritual leader. getting rid of witches, wizards, and so forth was to be done according to the law. In Leviticus 19, it says, "Regard not them that have familiar spirits, neither seek after wizards to be defiled by them. I am the Lord your God." Exodus 22:18 says, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." So it's very clear cut. That's how it was. In verse 4, it goes on here in our passage. "And the Philistines gathered themselves together and came and pitched at Shunem. And Saul gathered all Israel together, and they pitched in Gilboa. And when Saul saw the host of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart greatly trembled. And when Saul inquired of the Lord answered him not, neither by dreams, nor by Urim, nor by the prophets." We see here that Saul was afraid, and his heart greatly trembled. And fear is what's going to drive him in the wrong direction, as we'll see. Saul was all alone. It's so emphasized that he's alone here. And it's ironic that he thought he could still seek the Lord. It says he was afraid and his heart greatly trembled, and Saul inquired of the Lord. After all that he has done against the Lord, he's killed his prophets or his priests, right? He's been chasing righteous David. He's lied and connived and all these things. Samuel, a man that he had actually grown to resent, was dead. And yet he thought that he could call on the Lord. And Saul inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered him not. And he gives these three things: neither by dreams, nor by Urim, nor by the prophets. So when it mentions dreams, but then it mentions Urim. Can anybody here tell me what, when it says neither by Urim nor by prophets, what's Urim? It sounds like one of those essential oils that comes in like a little vial, right? But does anybody here have an idea what Urim is?
Urim and Thummim.
So you're saying that the Lord spoke through... No. You're right. So, remember when David was trapped? It's one of the reasons that... if the Lord's not going to speak, he's not going to speak. But Saul didn't... I don't believe Saul had access to this method at all anyway. Remember when David was trapped in the walled city that he had rescued from the Philistines when the Philistines were robbing the threshing floors? It says Abiathar had taken the ephod when he escaped from Saul when the priests were killed. So he had taken the ephod. And somehow God spoke by means of the ephod. And the ephod had Urim and Thummim. Yeah. You're right. And so it's in... I'm not sure exactly. It says, in Exodus 28:30, if we go to Exodus chapter 28, let's look at this passage. It's not mentioned very many times, the specific way. It's unique. That's why I wanted to kind of follow it up when it says he didn't speak to him by dreams, nor Urim by the prophets. It says in Exodus 28 and verse 30, "And thou shalt put in the breastplate of judgment the Urim and the Thummim. And they shall be upon Aaron's heart when he goeth in before the Lord. And Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel upon his heart before the Lord continually." So this is what would have been involved. And it says that the Lord didn't speak to Saul, neither by dreams, nor Urim, nor by the prophets. And so experts don't know for sure what it is. The breastplates did have 12 stones of the tribes of Israel with the names engraved thereon. What's interesting is when Urim is mentioned, the stones are not. And when the stones are mentioned, the use of Urim is absent, leading most people to believe that they're one and the same thing. Either way, God would speak through the priests at times when wearing the ephod. Saul didn't have access to this, and so God wasn't speaking to him at all. Saul was like so many lost people, though this is what's really more important, is Saul was like so many lost people, and I have a question for you at the end of this lesson, whether Saul was saved or lost, or whether he'll be in heaven or what. It's an interesting thing. A lot of people have different opinions, but I'll just say that Saul was like so many lost people who only, well, Christians are this way too.
Yes.
He only wanted good news about the future. Christians can actually grow so far away from the Lord that it's hard to even discern whether or not they're saved anymore. And then the Lord takes them out sometimes. But he only wanted good news about his future. Am I going to be successful? He was facing trouble. He was fearful. He wanted to have peace in his heart. He wanted God to speak. He didn't care about what the Lord had to say about chasing David. He didn't care about what the Lord had to say when he was offering sacrifice when he shouldn't, or doing whatever with the ark. In the past, Saul didn't care that much about what the Lord had to say. But boy, when he was going into battle, Saul had all kinds of concern about what the Lord had to say about it. And just like a lot of lost people, they don't really want to hear, listen, the Lord is going to give an answer. There is an answer that's not always what we want to hear.
Right?
Be careful how much you are really seeking to know what's in your future, because you might not like it, especially if you're the enemy of God. And so he did not care about God's will for his everyday life. He did not care about being obedient to God. He wanted nothing to do with ridding his life of sin and humbling himself before God, but he sure wanted to know what the Lord, he was inquiring of the Lord. And so that's how it is with a lot of the religious people of our day even.
Yeah.
They want a preacher to tickle their ears with blessings and be comforted in times of trouble and so forth. They want to be helped when there's family problems and all that. But seeking advice concerning where they're struggling, concerning sin in their life, not so much. Help me with my family? Yes. Overcome sin? No, not really. And concerning prophecy and end times, people want to know all about what the Bible has to say. They're fascinated with revelation, but they don't really want anything to do with the God of the Bible, though. And so they want comfort for this life, but don't care about the things of eternity. Men have always been the same, though. Saul is so desperate. So what does he do? If the Lord's not, here's what's so interesting. If the Lord isn't talking to you, well, then let's go to the devil. Right? If God's not going to talk to me, I got to know about the future. So let's go talk to a witch.
Yeah.
Yes. Isn't that amazing? Instead of getting right and falling on your knees and humbling yourself and calling out for the Lord to know, I need to know what's going to happen. I'm going to go look for a witch. So verse 7. Then said Saul unto his servant, seek me a woman that hath a familiar spirit, that I may go to her and inquire of her. And his servant said to him, behold, there is a woman that hath a familiar spirit at Endor. Remember, Saul had killed off most of the witches. And Saul disguised himself and put on other raiment, and he went, and two men with him, and they came to the woman by night. And he said, I pray thee, divine unto me by the familiar spirit, and bring him up, whom I shall name unto thee. And the woman said unto him, behold, thou knowest what Saul hath done, how he hath cut off those that have familiar spirits, and the wizards out of the land. Wherefore then layest thou a snare for my life to cause me to die? And Saul sware to her by the Lord, saying, as the Lord liveth. This is just so amazing. As the Lord liveth, telling a witch, there shall no punishment happen to thee for this thing. And so she, because he said, as the Lord liveth, this witch said, okay. What's going on here? So then said the woman, whom shall I bring up unto thee? And he said, bring me up Samuel. So we see here in verse 11 just how mentally unstable and irrational he has become. Who was Samuel? What was Samuel? He's a prophet of God. He's going to a witch to bring up the prophet of God so that he can hear what Samuel would have to say. How was he going to speak to him, or what was Saul hoping to hear from Samuel? This isn't very logical. So he goes to find a woman with a familiar spirit to raise up the prophet of God. Does a witch have the power over the people of God, even when they've died? No. No. Can any person bring back a witch or not? Can anybody bring back someone from the dead so that they can talk to the living? Is that possible? No. That's not possible. So how does this usually work? Deuteronomy 18:10 says this: "There shall not be found among you any other that maketh his son or daughter to pass through the fire, or that uses divination, or an observer of times, or an enchanter, or a witch, or a charmer, or a consulter with familiar spirits, or a wizard, or a necromancer." So there's all these different types that are mentioned here that use familiar spirits, divination, observer of times, enchanter, witch, charmer, consulter with familiar spirits, a wizard, or a necromancer. One with a familiar spirit, as it is termed in 1 Samuel, could engage in several practices. And it's obvious that this woman of Endor, specifically was a necromancer. One who claims to communicate with the dead. That was their specific gifts. And they were actually, often they were ventriloquists. So they practiced and developed the skill of being a ventriloquist. So when they would bring up someone from the dead, they could talk to the people in a different voice, and it was the voice of the person that was coming from the beyond and stuff. And so it was trickery. And there have been people, truly people, demon-possessed who deal in all kinds of arts, but they are limited in their knowledge and certainly cannot truly communicate with the dead. What do we see in this passage then? It was God allowing something to happen. That's what happened here. And there's evidence of it. There is evidence in this passage that this woman had never seen a dead person in her life. And it freaked her out. And so verse 12, "And when the woman saw Samuel, she cried with a loud voice. And the woman spake to Saul, saying, Why hast thou deceived me? For thou art Saul." I don't think she really expected Samuel to come up. And when she saw him, she cried out. Why did she cry out? It should not have been because it was Samuel. After all, that's who she was calling up. So why'd she cry out? It's because it actually worked. And I think she cried with a loud voice because it's the first time she ever successfully had called up a dead spirit. But it was only done with God's allowance. In verse 13 it says, "And the king said unto her, Be not afraid, for what sawest thou? And the woman said unto Saul, I saw gods ascending out of the earth. And he said unto her, What form is he of? And she said, An old man cometh up, and he is covered with a mantle. And Saul perceived that it was Samuel, and he stooped with his face to the ground and bowed himself. And Samuel said to Saul, Why hast thou disquieted me to bring me up?" Who has the power to allow this situation to take place? Those who love the Lord and who die as the children of God are at rest or at peace with the Lord. The only way that this was allowed to even take place is because God allowed it to take place. And so, Saul answered, "I am sore distressed, for the Philistines make war against me, and God has departed from me, and answereth me no more, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I have called thee, that thou mayest make known unto me what I shall do." Then said Samuel, "Wherefore then dost thou ask of me, seeing the Lord is departed from thee, and is become thine enemy? And the Lord hath done to him as he spoke by me, for the Lord hath rent the kingdom out of thine hand, and given it to thy neighbor, even to David. Because thou obeyed not the voice of the Lord, nor executest his fierce wrath upon Amalek, therefore hath the Lord done this thing unto thee. this day. We shouldn't be shocked, and Saul shouldn't have been shocked or amazed because the word of the Lord was coming to pass. That's what was happening here in this passage. Samuel says in verse 16, "Wherefore then dost thou ask of me, seeing the Lord has departed from thee and become thine enemy?" When he says the Lord is become thine enemy, that's the worst place to be. There's no worse place to be than the Lord is your enemy. And he's been told, being told that. Now we have to keep in mind, Samuel doesn't debate with Saul. When Saul says, "God is departed from me and answereth me no more," Samuel doesn't debate with him whether or not God had ever been with him. He says, "Wherefore then dost ask of me, seeing the Lord is departed from thee and has become thine enemy?" And so this is a done deal. This is a frightening place to be. Saul went to this woman and he had sought the direction of the Lord, and the answer that he got is a frightening answer. The Lord is your enemy. And what has been said was going to take place is now going to take place. And Samuel points out it was all taking place because of his past rebellion. Because you didn't do what you were told to do concerning Amalek and so forth. This is why this is happening. I told you when I was alive that this was going to happen. And it's going to happen. And so he says in verse 19, "Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with thee into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow thou and thy son shall be with thee, with me. The Lord shall also deliver the host of Israel into the hand of the Philistines." Then Saul fell straightway along the earth and was sore afraid because of the words of Samuel. And there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no bread all day nor all night. And the woman came unto Saul and saw that he was sore troubled, and said unto him, "Behold, thine handmaid hath obeyed thy voice, and have put my life in my hand, and have hearkened unto thy words." I want to just stop right here. Did you notice that once Samuel came up, it was part of a necromancer, if they brought someone back from the dead, that then they would help with the whole communication back and forth and interpret and this and that. You notice when Saul came up, she cried out with a loud voice, and she was sore afraid, and she had nothing to do with any of it. And then now that it's all gone, Saul communicated with Samuel, and now she enters back into the scene and says, I have put my life in thy hand, and have hearkened unto thy words which thou spakest to me. Thou therefore, I pray thee, hearken thou also unto the voice of thine handmaid, and let me set a morsel of bread before thee, and eat, that thou mayest have strength when thou goest thy way. But he refused and said, I will not eat. But his servants together with the woman compelled him, and he hearkened unto their voice. So he arose from the earth and sat upon the bed. And the woman had a fat calf in the house, and she hasted and killed it, and took flour and kneaded it, and did bake unleavened bread thereof. And she brought it before Saul and before his servants, and they did eat. And they rose up and went away that night. As we conclude this chapter, knowledge of his future did not ease his fear. Then Saul, it says in verse 20, "Then Saul fell straightway along the earth and was sore afraid because of the words of Samuel, and there was no strength in him." On one hand, he had been afraid of the uncertainty. And then he was afraid of the certainty. It's better for people in this life to be afraid of the uncertainty, and that caused them to turn to the Lord and put their trust in him, because there is a certain point where the certainty is going to become a reality for people. And when they're in eternity, there's no turning back. There's nothing you can do against it. And that's a state. Saul was in a certain state of condemnation here. There was no turning back. The final day of judgment had approached. It was at hand. He had been told what was going to happen. He knew it was going to happen. And he was so afraid, he couldn't move. He fell to the floor. He was done. That, and to be told that the Lord is thy enemy, and this is what's going to happen. And by tomorrow, you're going to be dead. That's a terrible, terrible place to be. It hadn't always been like that for Saul. When Saul first became king, he prophesied. He was friends with Samuel. The Lord had blessed him and dealt with him. But throughout his life, little disobedience here, more disobedience there, more stubbornness, bullheadedness, and then it just snowballed and spiraled. Did this prompt him to repent? We don't see that he turned to the Lord and cried out for mercy and for forgiveness or anything like that. He just went about his way. And so it is so with so many lost people, as I've already mentioned. If they knew their future, you will die today. If you could tell, a lot of people, they're on their deathbed. You're alienated from God. You must repent. They can be afraid of dying. They can even know where they're going and not have any peace of eternity. And yet they don't repent.
Right.
It's an amazing thing. How is your heart? The question should be, how is our heart? How is your heart? God can melt that heart of stone.
Amen.
He absolutely can crush that heart of stone. And what's amazing is he can replace the fear and dread that people have. Even in the face of death, he can replace that sense of dread and fear with a sense of peace. It's an amazing thing. All that turn to him, he will in no wise cast out. But once you die, it's over. That's all there is. So a question I have, did Saul go to heaven? Did Saul go to heaven? It's an interesting thing, and I've believed that, no, he was a wicked man. I've believed that. However, there's a very interesting verse that we just read.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys pick up on it?
Yeah.
It reminds me of the thief on the cross. The thief on the cross who turned to Christ, he said, "Remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom." Now that's interesting because the thief was able to recognize that Jesus, the Son of Man, who was dying in front of him, it was also his kingdom. He believed that he was also the Son of God. And he said, "Remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom, not your father's kingdom." But, and Jesus said what? "Today shalt thou be with me in paradise," right? Was Jonathan a saved man? Absolutely. He was a man of God, a righteous man. Saul went to the same place that Jonathan did, according to this verse. God told Saul that he was going to be with him. To me, early on in Saul's life, there is evidence that you could look at and go, yeah, he was probably a child of God. As his life went on, he was like, man, I just don't see how a child of God would do that. But it's very interesting. Let's read verse 19 again. "Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow thou and thy sons shall be with me."
He didn't say paradise.
He meant among the dead.
Among the dead.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly.
There's two different
positions. And so, with me, shalt thou and thy sons be with me, though. I just think that it's interesting, isn't it? It's still open for debate, and we won't know till we get there. But I thought it was a very interesting way that it was termed. When we consider, let's say, Lazarus and the rich man, right? Which one would you say was with the Lord? Was the rich man in hell with the Lord? Or I think Lazarus was with the Lord. So that's my conclusion, Pastor. You can come and clean it up.
That was no conclusion.